Hey there, my name's Oisín Lunny and welcome to Audio Talks, presented to you by Harman. And today we're talking about something most of us never think about. What happens to the music we love after it's made? Who protects it and who decides what survives? In 2008, a fire at Universal Studios destroyed hundreds of thousands of master recordings, the original tapes of artists like Aretha Franklin, Nirvana and Elton John. It was one of the biggest cultural losses in music history, and for years, almost no one knew about it. So joining us on the podcast today to explore what the loss of audio archives like this means and what we can do about it are two people on the front lines of audio preservation. Welcome to the podcast, the curator of the Performing Arts Collection at UC Santa Barbara, David Soibert.
Hello, Oisín.
Great to have you here, David. Thanks for joining us. And welcome to the podcast, Music Industry OG, an advocate for global preservation efforts and former executive director of the National Recording Preservation Foundation and former VP of Strategic Marketing of EMI's global catalogue in over 43 territories. Welcome, Gerald Seligman.
Very nice to be here and thanks for the invitation.
Fantastic. So let's jump right into it. I'd like to start with yourself, David. I wonder if you could share with our listeners just why exactly are master recordings so important? So, you know, what's lost when they disappear like this beyond just better sound quality?
Yeah, it's difficult to explain sometimes why master recordings are important, especially when people think that everything's on Spotify. But I think the real tragedy in something like the Universal Fire was all of the things that don't exist anywhere else. All the, you know, the singles from 1952 that came out and never got reissued. So the master recording was the only thing there. I mean, we'll always be able to listen to those John Coltrane impulse recordings, even though the masters were lost, because there's other copies out there. But there's a lot of stuff where there weren't other copies available except the ones that were lost in the fire.
When you put it that way, it feels like a profound loss for these things just to disappear forever. But Gerald, coming over to your good self, I know you've been involved in preservation of recordings for a long time, but what's your take on why these recordings are so important?
A good example is what's being done currently with the Beatles catalog. They've gone back to the original master tapes and actually remixed and remastered the recordings. And if you hold up side by side the original mixes, especially the original stereo mixes of the early albums, which were very inferior, and what they've been able to do subsequently, you realize how important it is that they had those master tapes and the source material to go back to.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's like the old master tapes, you know, they kind of travel through time to an era where we have all of this additional technology and DSP and equipment to bring the best out of the recording. So they kind of shift context as well. But Gerald, staying with yourself, when you think about preserving recordings, are you thinking about only music recordings or is there a broader aspect to this?
There is a much broader aspect, because what we're talking about is audio preservation. And audio includes not only music and the history of music and recorded sound, but also broadcast and spoken word. And this is the kind of material that doesn't have necessarily a commercial impact and a commercial potential. And therefore, there's less incentive to preserve it. A couple of brief examples of what it is we're talking about. A short excerpt by somebody named Fountain Hughes. I find it chilling, no matter how many times I've heard it. Or if you look at other ones through history and the importance, Winston Churchill. One last one, again, showing the importance of not just music for audio preservation, but broadcast and radio and famous ones. This is Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream. Those are the three excerpts I think that demonstrate as well as anything can the importance of preserving not just music, but the history and broadcast and cultural broadcast as well. It doesn't have to be, you know, from history itself.
Well said. It's literally one of those moments when you hear an audio recording and you get those goosebumps on the back of your neck. Those are iconic moments in human history, and you really put it in perspective there, the importance of these audio moments being captured and preserved. It's a moment in history as well as a moment of recording. But I'm really curious to get to know your backstories, and I'd love to start with yourself, David. What inspired you to get so directly involved in preserving audio recordings?
Well, I've been a record collector since I was a kid. And I was living in San Francisco in the 1990s and trying to figure out what to do with myself and how to turn a hobby as a record collector into something that paid the bills. And I ended up going to library school and kind of married my love of organization and preservation and history with my record collecting hobby and ended up here at UC Santa Barbara curating the recorded sound archives, where we have almost 400,000 recordings here in the collection. So a little bit of luck, a little bit of planning, but marrying two things together that don't necessarily seem to fit together is how I ended up doing what I do.
I love it. So luck, planning, and a lot of love for recorded audio right there. That's brilliant. I bet there's a lot of record collectors listening to the podcast thinking, oh, wow, dream job. You get paid to collect records.
It is a dream job for sure.
That's brilliant. And Gerald, you are no stranger to having one or two items of beautiful vinyl in your house as well. Talk to us a bit about your own path in terms of how you got involved so directly in preserving audio recordings.
Well, like David, it began with a very early childhood interest in music and records. And, you know, it was a different kind of event, the release of an album back then than it is now, of course. And it led eventually to my being able to work in the music industry, and then finally in running a record label for EMI, which was called EMI Hemisphere. It was music from all over the world. And so in a way, working at the end of my career, because I'm now 69, on the preservation of music, it's kind of a sweet arc going from interest in music to creation of music, and then finally at the end of my career to working to help preserve music and recorded sound.
There's a very elegant symmetry about all of that. And I just want to say what a great label Hemisphere is. I've got many Hemisphere CDs and releases, and really you brought so much high quality music to the world using the enormous machinery of EMI. So that was just a kind of pivotal moment, I think, for many people's record collections, I'm sure David included.
Gerald's label turned me on to world music 20 years before we ever met.
That's brilliant. I'm so happy to hear that. I'm sure there's many people listening at home nodding in full agreement there. So let's kind of shift our focus to this revelatory article in the New York Times. And it's one that would have brought a chill to any decent record collector who read about all these thousands of hours of iconic audio recordings just going up in smoke. One of those moments, where were you when ... When did you first hear about the 2008 Universal fire, and how did it hit you personally or professionally?
Well, I was living in Santa Barbara at the time, so it was, you know, just 100 miles to the south in Los Angeles. So we heard about it in real time on the news. But it wasn't until much later where we kind of grasped the full impact of what had happened, particularly with Jody Rosen's article in the Times. It kind of exposed all the tragedy there. But I really think it shows how archives in general are neglected. I mean, the archives is the heart of a record label in terms of their catalog. And to not spend the modest amounts of money on safeguards to prevent things like fires or whatever is just really short-sighted and a tragedy.
Strong agree there. That's a great anecdote. And Gerald, you know, where were you when you heard about all of this? You obviously both were featured in this article. It was so shocking. I mean, what do you think this fire revealed about how the music industry values or undervalues its own history?
Pulling back just a little bit, we have to appreciate the fact that for commercial ventures like record companies, there's no longer money in recorded sound. You know, thanks first to piracy and now this very abusive system of streaming where almost nothing is paid to artists and all the profits going to the companies and the shareholders. The commercial consideration in preserving archives is no longer the money that can be made. And therefore, this kind of tragedy comes from that situation. As David said, you know, they're not doing the minimum to protect these. But at the same time, it demonstrates that something outside of the commercial system needs to be done for preservation. And it needs to be done jointly, not only for the most commercial, but for those cultural artifacts that there's less money in, but that have equal importance in world culture.
Well said, indeed. This kind of brings us nicely onto, you know, the whole approach to archiving. So David, you are an archivist. And from your perspective, how would you say that public institutions approach the preservation differently from commercial record labels, as Gerald just mentioned there?
Yeah, great question, because our mission is the preservation of historically important documents, whether they're paper, photographs, or sound recordings. We're not in it to exploit things for their commercial or monetary value. So we make decisions on what we archive based on historical importance. So things like, you know, wax cylinders from the 1890s that we have here at UC Santa Barbara's collection have very little commercial potential, if any, but they're historically important because they're the earliest recordings that were made by humankind. So that's how we approach things, is trying to do that. Another one of my favorite collecting areas is, you know, somewhat inspired by Gerald's work at EMI, which is world music, or what we call global music now. The record industry in the 1920s and 30s was recording unbelievable numbers of recordings by immigrant Americans and non-English language speakers because they wanted to listen to their music too. And most of these recordings have been neglected for decades. And that's one of the principal focuses here at UCSB, is to preserve all those incredible recordings of vernacular music from that time period that really have no commercial potential in the marketplace, but great historical value.
Amazing. And David, I read in one of your interviews online, which is really fascinating, about something called the discography of American historical recordings. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, that's a project that was actually started in the 1960s by a couple of record collectors who wanted to document the history of the American recording industry. In particular, they wanted to document the Victor Talking Machine Company, one of the earliest record labels. And there just wasn't information out there in terms about when things were recorded, where things were recorded. So they got access to the archives at Victor, which is now part of Sony, and started compiling this discography. It moved to Santa Barbara in the mid-2000s, and we have continued that work. We now have information online on about 430,000 mostly American sound recordings. And with the agreement of Sony Music in New York City, we have a license to stream anything that we hold in the collection. And we're ticking up towards 100,000 digitized early sound recordings that are available through the discography. So it's a really exciting way to marry sort of historical research, documentation, and preservation along with a public access to these important recordings.
Oh my goodness, that's outstanding. So you've been involved in a lot of projects that have saved, you know, very significant recordings and entire collections. You're talking hundreds and thousands of records. Has this taught you about anything to do with the fragility of audio heritage? Because it sounds like you're saving these recordings just in time in many cases.
I mean, the fragility of audio heritage is partly inherent to the unstable media that things were recorded on. But it's also, you know, the instability of humankind. There was a collection in Los Angeles that we got, maybe 10 years ago. The gentleman had died. His collection was in a storage unit. The son had to move the collection out of that storage unit. And through the help of some collector friends in LA, we were able to rescue the collection. And the great thing about that is the two things that were super interesting in that collection. There was a TV show called The Stars of Jazz, important Los Angeles TV show, and the soundtracks were released by Armed Forces Radio in the United States. And so the UCLA was able to use those soundtrack discs to restore the television shows to their original glory. And then there were also radio transcription discs of Nat King Cole. And when the producers of the Nat King Cole box set 5 or 6 years ago were looking for these lost radio shows, they were all in this collection. I didn't know that at the time. It wasn't my genius or anything that resulted in the preservation of those, but because we were able to, you know, muster forces together and bring that collection to Santa Barbara, the public is now able to hear those important recordings again. So I consider that a success story of what we do here.
Absolutely. That's a definite win from the archives there. I love it. Thank you, David. And Gerald, coming over to yourself now, you said something really interesting earlier, particularly about the reasons or not that record labels would preserve audio recordings. You mentioned cost can be an issue, the changing business models, where the profit comes from. Why do you think the industry has struggled to prioritize preservation?
The record labels are commercial organizations, and therefore everything is governed by commercial concerns. So, of course, within the record companies, there are people who understand the importance of preservation, but the budgets simply aren't there because the money isn't there, the potential for earnings. But, you know, there's a certain assumption that people make because of the sheer quantity of material available online and streaming. There's an assumption that most everything is streamable these days. And David, you probably know this, the percentage of recorded music that's actually available in streaming is very low, isn't it?
Yeah, and a significant amount of it is just lost forever. There's tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of recordings that were made before World War II where the masters don't exist anymore and people want to listen to them, but they're not there.
Right, or they're recorded on media that has deteriorated beyond repair. So the commercial consideration gives us the illusion that it's all there and it's all available and it's all preserved. It's not. And if you think about if commercial potential is the sole criteria for what gets preserved, Johann Sebastian Bach was relatively forgotten for centuries until Felix Mendelssohn sort of rediscovered him and reintroduced his works into the public. And now, of course, Bach is considered, you know, one of the greatest composers of all time. But so the commercial consideration would have said, oh, this is not worth preserving. Nobody's interested. The cultural concern says otherwise.
And those Bach manuscripts survived because they were on paper. But if they had been, you know, analog open reel tape, they would have lasted, you know, 50 years and then that would have been it. They wouldn't have been able to last until Mendelssohn rediscovered them.
Damn. I mean, it sounds like we're a bit deluded in terms of as music listeners and folks who have access to record collections and streaming services. Like you say, we assume that everything's fine. There's so much music out there. What could possibly go wrong? But as you're both saying loud and clear, this is actually a very fragile moment of human history that, thanks to the good graces of amazing people like yourselves and your colleagues, we are managing to keep, but it doesn't always work out for the best. So what would you say are some of the obstacles in terms of building, you know, the nirvana of archiving, a comprehensive long-term system for preserving audio history?
I think space and money are the two considerations. You know, there's stuff out there and we need places to put it. And in order to properly do our job as an archive, we need the funding both for cataloging, digitization technicians, computer infrastructure, all that sort of stuff. I think with more money, we could do a lot more. And we do a lot with what we have, but we're not funded in the way that can fully do that. And there's not very many. I mean, Library of Congress is very active in doing this, Santa Barbara, other places as well. But there aren't enough institutions sinking money into this endeavor to really stem the tide of the loss of collections.
The Library of Congress, which David just mentioned, is doing a remarkable job of not only preservation, but acquiring catalogs. A complication is copyright issues, where they have the material, but of course the copyright may be owned by someone else. Let's say, you know, one of the major record companies, the few that are left. And therefore, what they can do with these archives to make them accessible to the general public is limited by copyright. There are so many complications to be considered in audio preservation.
And that's why we struck a deal with Sony. You know, funding preservation is intrinsically important, but if I approach somebody, you know, granting agency or funding agency with a proposal, what we call dark archiving, where we preserve things just to preserve them, isn't very attractive. But if you can say, well, we're going to preserve this stuff and we're going to make it accessible, that is much more likely to open up that funding stream. And because Santa Barbara did ink that deal with Sony where we could make their recordings accessible, we've been able to successfully ramp up our preservation to a level that we weren't doing before that agreement.
Glad to hear it. I mean, this opens up a whole can of worms around copyright, as you're both saying, you know, the right to publish and bring this amazing archived audio to the world. What are your thoughts on the rights of the artists? You know, because I know sometimes the master recordings can get stuck in a dusty warehouse somewhere, Indiana Jones style. You know, should artists have more rights to their master recordings if the labels have kind of forgotten about this stuff?
Absolutely. And the history of recorded music is the history of denying, sadly, artists the money they deserve from their own cultural output and their own creation. If you think about the old blues recordings back in the day where they were, you know, paid $5 and maybe a bottle of bourbon or something like that, which is, you know, a cliche to say, but actually was a common practice. Artists from that time have struggled for rights and to make a living out of their own work and their own creations. Of course, the deals are much better now, but if you think about it, recording costs on an average album are all recoupable by the record companies. And it's a fascinating dynamic that's set up because the artist, in a typical record deal, especially old pre-streaming, the artist would pay for the recording through recoupment. The recording cost was recoupable by the record label. And once those costs were recouped, the label still owned the master tapes. So in a way, it's very much like you've been paying a mortgage on your house and you finally paid off the entire mortgage and the bank still owns your home. So the system itself is inequitable and has been for a very long time. So artists, to answer your question, most definitely should earn more from their material. And if they had their own master tapes, they have a greater interest in preserving them so that they'll exist, you know, for future generations.
Indeed, indeed. It's like that famous quote, was it Hunter S. Thompson said, the music industry is a long and hollow money trench full of pimps and thieves where good men die like dogs, or you know, something along those lines. And there's also a negative side. So that classic quote there, you know, you've just kind of highlighted the artists. So let's kind of double click on this idea of specific genres or artists or cultural movements. You know, which genres, artists or cultural movements would you say are at the highest risk of disappearing due to this lack of preservation?
Well, I think the older the material is, the more likely it is to be at risk. I think certain time periods as well. You know, there's a lot of stuff that was recorded on digital multi-track tapes that is not unplayable, but pretty close to it and getting harder to play. You know, obviously the fungible media like wax cylinders, you know, you play them on the wrong machine one time, it's gone forever, and it was likely a unique recording. There's all kinds of little examples like that, and we just need to be more aware of this history and all the different aspects of it before we lose, you know, whole tranches of our recorded history.
And there's also music from the 60s that was recorded on an infamous brand of Ampex tape, where the actual emulsion flaked off the tapes. And recordings that were far more recent than wax cylinders are damaged, many beyond repair.
Sounds like a William Baczynski recording waiting to happen there, those kind of disintegration loops, but perhaps only good if it's intentional there. But let's look at, you know, actual functional technology. Are there any current efforts or technologies or partnerships that give you great hope for the future of audio archiving?
Well, there's new digital technologies for restoration. There's optical scanning of recordings that are broken, for example. Like if you have a cylinder recording that is in many pieces, it would have been unplayable 15 years ago. Now we can use high quality imaging technologies to kind of piece the recordings back together. And there's been some really interesting discoveries and rediscoveries from these optical technologies being used for, you know, 19th century or damaged recordings.
Fantastic. Very glad to hear it. You know, Gerald, I'd like to direct this at yourself, because of course, you know, you released so much music when you're at Hemisphere, you brought so much music to the world, and a lot of this would have been created by humans, created by, you know, real players, real instruments, you know, with synthesizer instruments, drum machines, whatever it was, but it was all human creativity. And we're now kind of segueing into this era where I think there's a huge percentage of the music that's being thrown at the streaming platforms is AI created, because there are all kinds of scams going on with royalty collection, etc. So it feels like we're sort of moving into this era where a lot of the content being created is AI generated. In terms of like preserving the audio that we've just lived through since the beginning of recorded music, would you think this is a distinct era of human creativity that needs to be preserved?
It's a very interesting question. Luckily, we have 6 hours for this podcast so that we can delve into it. I mean, the whole AI question is fascinating, and what some of the streaming services are doing, as you say, they're creating these fake tracks, you know, so now we go from fake news to fake tracks. So yes, the era of actual human input into the creation of music is that much more important.
Yeah, born digital preservation is a real concern for archivists. And I think the challenge here is, you know, you've got a legitimate amount of born digital sound recordings that are made on Pro Tools and never see physical media. You know, they're just on hard drives. And that obviously, you know, actual creative output of human beings needs to be preserved. But then if you're mixing it up with tens of thousands or millions of AI tracks, how do you tell what to do? I'm thankful that at least the way I view my role here at Santa Barbara is, you know, if I can't touch it, it's not my responsibility to preserve. Obviously, the archival profession, more broadly speaking, needs to take this seriously, but it's a can of worms for future generations for sure.
Wow. Well, that's a good, you know, line to have drawn in one's own personal sand. I do like that. If you can't hold it, you know, forget it. So I have another question, and this is more of a broader run around the cultural significance of recorded audio. Gerald, you brought out some incredible quotes there. Winston Churchill, Martin Luther King. Sometimes culture can be these snapshots of the vanguard of freedom of expression and freedom of speech. And in some political configurations, this can be unwelcome. So do you think the work of an archivist can have a political aspect as well?
Absolutely. I mean, we're living in a moment in the U.S., which sadly we're only at the very beginning of, where we've got a government that is actively erasing history, you know, censoring books, trying to control what universities are able to do, and actually erasing and deleting, destroying websites of African-American history and women's history and all the rest. So here again is another importance of independent archiving that is not dependent on government support, that's not dependent on commercial support, but rather is interested in history, culture, the arts, and all the rest.
UC Santa Barbara's discography of American historical recordings has received government support over the years. I do think of archivists' work as political. I mean, we're trying to preserve recordings of, you know, groups from pre-World War II that are, you know, overlooked and underrepresented. And my government funding was just canceled 2 weeks ago.
So this is a question for both of you. It seems like the clock is ticking because you mentioned that this physical media is deteriorating. You know, what should our listeners know about this time limit?
Well, it is ticking. A lot of this stuff, the equipment is going to last for less time than the actual audio media will. And without one, you can't preserve the other.
And if you look at the Culpeper facility of the Library of Congress, it was formerly where they were going to send government if there was a nuclear war with Russia. So it's these underground caverns, and it's filled with broken machinery of all kinds, which they're always buying because they have to use these parts, since they're not being manufactured anymore, to repair the playback equipment that is deteriorating and would disappear otherwise. So the window is narrow.
Yeah, we archive equipment as well. We have 13 Studer decks at Santa Barbara that hopefully will allow us to keep preserving this stuff for the next 50 years or so.
So if there's folks listening to the podcast and they're inspired and they want to help, what kind of things can our listeners do? You know, what's the audience's role in this? Can the public help to preserve sound history?
Well, I think it starts with, you know, the stuff that you have, whether you're an independent musician or, you know, the owner of a record label or somebody that works in a library archive, just to, you know, take responsibility for what you've got. We've all got to contribute individually. There's no central archive in the sky. The Library of Congress can't do everything. They've got a lot to do, but everybody can contribute to the preservation of their own collections and recordings that are out there.
And the other thing, of course, is to wherever, whenever possible, support artists by actually making sure that the access you have to their music and the purchases you make don't go to a streaming service, but actually go to the artist, him or herself.
Fantastic. Words to live by right there. And speaking of supporting the artist, we do have a streaming playlist, which we invite all of our VIP guests to contribute to. Everyone from Carl Cox to A.R. Rahman to Imogen Heap, and everyone chooses a track. And this is a way to bring attention to recordings that just we love or that are meaningful to all of our guests. So with that in mind, could I invite each of you to contribute a track to our VIP Tidal playlist and maybe buy it on Bandcamp as well?
One of my favorite recordings I discovered was a 1930s recording made in Paris of Lecuona's Cuban Boys, of a song called Dime Adios. And I just think it's this glorious Cuban-infused track. You know, it's not unknown. It's probably out there. It's an incredible song, and I'm sure the audience will love it.
Fantastic. I want this in my life immediately. Thank you for that, David. And Gerald, coming over to yourself. Now, both of you have arguably millions of potential tracks to choose from. What would you like to add to our playlist?
Yeah, I've also got an America second track. You know, so often it's music that in and of itself has great value, but very often what we love in music is something that had a great impact on us and may have sent us in directions that we wouldn't have gone in otherwise. And for me, in 1979, for the first time I heard the Brazilian Milton Nascimento, I could say it was life-changing because it sent me on a direction buying albums, looking into contemporary of the time, Brazilian music from the 70s, and then I ended up living there and working in their record industry and all the rest. So Milton Nascimento, Clube de Esquina number 2, a song called E Daí, which kind of means, and then, you know, as a question, and then. It is a harrowingly spiritual, moving song.
Oh my God, goosebumps just hearing that. I believe you worked with Milton when you were on Hemisphere, is that right?
I did put that album out, which was kind of exciting, you know, as a reissue, because I thought, wow, I discovered this in my room in New York City in 1979. And in fact, he once said, he said, oh, what brought you to Brazil? And I pointed at him and I said, you did.
Oh my God. That again, a beautiful symmetry right there, Gerald. So listen, thank you so much. My own contribution to this episode's playlist is going to be pretty directly on the theme, and it's Aretha Franklin with Save Me, the Queen of Soul. I can just never get enough of that.
How interesting you mentioned Aretha Franklin. You may be aware of an audio preservation project that went back to the original recording sessions of Aretha Franklin, and they released a 2-CD set of outtakes, alternate versions, and all the rest. And it's from the Atlantic era, the gold of her output. So without those master tapes, without that preservation, we wouldn't have this amazing additional look at what she did back in her prime.
Oh, Madre Mia, shoot that into my veins. Thank you. What a perfect note to end on right there. I'd like to close with a little quote from Professor Anna Shinternshis, who was involved in an amazing project called Yiddish Glory that was all about saving and preserving the recordings and the songwriting that both Hitler and Stalin tried to extinguish. And this is often the voices of children. It's a very sad backstory, but she said something beautiful. She said, there is something about music that keeps us sane and helps us make sense of things that nothing else does. And I think that really speaks to the power and the importance of preserving audio recordings. So a huge thanks to both of you for sharing your knowledge, your passion, for preserving our musical past, helping us to understand how it makes sense of the world today and what it means for our collective future. Thank you so much to David Soibert.
Thank you so much.
And thank you so much, Gerald Seligman.
And thank you for publicizing such an important issue.
Listeners, if you're a music lover or an artist or just someone who cares about cultural memory, don't forget this isn't just history. We're living through this right now. You can find links in the show notes to learn more about some of the preservation efforts we've discussed today and how to support them. And if you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe, rate and share Audio Talks with your friends, family and connections. It really helps to get these important stories heard. For more exclusive content, some behind-the-scenes goodies, and maybe even some competitions, connect with us over on the Instagram. You can find us at Audio Talks Podcast. We'll be back soon for more immaculately preserved Audio Talks. See you next time.